Ezra, chapters 7 and 8. The third talk in a series on Ezra and Nehemiah was presented by Gil Greco on August 9, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Ezra Nehemiah Handout Number 2 accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Online Reformation Fellowship. My name is Gil Greco. We've been going through a series in Ezra Nehemiah. Over the past 2 weeks, we saw what I have called the prologue of Ezra Nehemiah. It covers the first 6 chapters in your traditional Bible. At the beginning of that section, Cyrus, king of Persia, made a decree that said that all of the Jews who wanted to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple could do so, and he gave them a grant of money so that they could put that together and pray to God on his behalf. This was in keeping with his sort of general policy towards nations who were in his empire. He wanted to be viewed as a savior. Persians in general wanted to be viewed as saviors, as opposed to the Assyrians and Babylonians, who sort of had this iron grip that they exercised over their people. And they just scattered everybody everywhere and put them willy-nilly, and the only unifying thing at the end of the day for the Assyrians, for the people who lived under the Assyrians and Babylonians, was that everyone hated the Assyrians and Babylonians. And so Persia sort of learned that lesson, and they returned a lot of people to their ancestral homes. They allowed them to practice the religion as they had, and part of that program was Cyrus allowing the Jews to go back to Israel to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. So the exiles return under Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Zerubbabel would be the king of Israel if that institution were in place, and Jeshua would be the high priest. And they break ground, and once they break ground, they are met by their neighbors who offer to help them build the temple. Since they've been worshiping Yahweh, since they had been put there by the Assyrians. And Jeshua and Zerubbabel are adamant that only unalloyed devotion to Yahweh is or should be involved in worshiping. And so their neighbors discourage them from building. I like that understatement, discourage. So then there is a section of that prologue that just jumps forward in time and shows a bunch of instances of opposition to Israel and building the temple. And then there's even some material that shows opposition to Israel just in general, even after the temple is built. Then Haggai and Zechariah, whose books we have, start prophesying. They encourage Zerubbabel and Jeshua. They get back to work. There apparently has been a turnover in the government. One of the ways their neighbors had discouraged them from building was by bribing sort of the bureaucracy above, you know, several levels between Cyrus and sort of their local government. They bribed officials sort of in the middle to keep them from being able to build what they needed to build. And apparently that management has changed. There's a new guy named Tattenai. Tattenai sends a letter off to Darius saying, hey, is it okay if these people are building? And it turns out Darius does a search and he finds the edict that Cyrus had, or the memo that Cyrus had written about rebuilding the temple. So under Darius and under Tattenai, the Israelites are allowed to continue building, and they succeed in rebuilding the temple, and they celebrate by celebrating the Passover. And it is this wonderful moment. And we see in this first section, as I've said before, Ezra Nehemiah breaks down into roughly five sections. The first section and the third section are about a king who is in favor of Israel, allowing them to complete some building project. So we've seen that in the prologue that we just went through. We're going to get a little bit more of that in the section we're about to see with Ezra. The second section is showing us that despite the blessings that God is conferring on Israel, they are still unfaithful. And we're gonna get to that next week. So that's a summary of where we've been. This week, my plan is to do chapters 7 and 8. All right, let's get into the text. So this is what I have called, if you have one of my handouts, chapter 1, Ezra's Memoirs. That's a little bit confusing if you're in a regular Bible because we're in chapter 7 of Ezra. But if we think of 1 through 6 as the prologue, then this is the first chapter. And we're starting in paragraph 26 of my handout. I'm going to just note at the outset that we're somewhere around 458 BC. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the text. All right. So this first paragraph here is chapter 7, 1 through 5. Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, there went up Ezra, son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalem, son of Zadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Marioth, son of Zerahiah, son of Uzi, son of Buki, son of Abishua, son of Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the chief priest. Artaxerxes I started his reign in 465 BC. When we last saw the Israelites, they completed the temple around 516 BC. This means that we are somewhere in the ballpark of 51, at least 51 years later, and we're going to be told in a couple of verses that we're in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, so that puts us roughly 57 to 58 years after the rebuilding of the temple, which puts us at 458 BC. We are given a genealogy of Ezra here, which is not as complete as the biblical record can make it. We know from First Chronicles that there are several generations which are not included in this genealogy. For our purposes, I would like to note a few things about Ezra's pedigree, but I'm not going to go through every single member of this line. First, Ezra is in the line of both Aaron and of Zadok, which means that he would have a legitimate claim to the high priesthood. Second, he is a son of Sariah, who we know from 1 Chronicles is the father of Jozadak, who we know from earlier in Ezra is the father of Jeshua. Now, we know that biblical genealogies are not always interested in preserving every single generation. We know from Chronicles that this genealogy in Ezra has skipped a couple of generations. We know from Matthew and Luke that the genealogies of Jesus skip generations. Part of this is due to the flexibility of the Hebrew, and I also presume the Greek if we're talking about the Matthew and Luke genealogies, the terms son and father, how flexible those terms are. It can mean immediate generation, right? Wendell is my son, and we would use the Hebrew term here, and that would be appropriate. And I am his father, and the Hebrew word there would be the appropriate word. But it can also mean something more like descendant, if you're a son, or ancestor, if we're talking about fathers. So in the case of Ezra, it's most likely that Sariah is his grandfather or maybe even his great-grandfather, since otherwise he would be Jeshua's uncle. There have been strange situations in history of uncles who are younger than their nephews, but it's just more likely, you know, in the regular course of things, uncles end up being older than their nephews. So it's probably the case that Ezra is a descendant of Sariah rather than his immediate son. I'm not married to that, and if we dug up some tablets that had genealogies or something, then I could be wrong, but based on the information that we have here and elsewhere in the Bible, that's kind of my best guess. I think it's a safe bet to kind of go that way. Okay, paragraph 27. This Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses, which Yahweh, God of Israel, had given. And the king granted him all he requested, because the hand of Yahweh his God was upon him. Some of the sons of Israel and some of the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants went up to Jerusalem in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes. He came to Jerusalem in the 5th month, which was in the 7th year of the king. For on the 1st of the 1st month he began to go up from Babylon, and on the 1st of the 5th month he came to Jerusalem, because the good hand of his God was upon him. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of Yahweh and to practice it, and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. Okay, so the first paragraph that we were looking at, he starts in on Ezra, and then he takes this long parenthetical section to talk about his pedigree. He's the son of this guy, the son of that guy, who's eventually goes all the way back to Aaron. So he's just reminding us that who he's talking about. He's talking about this Ezra. He's not talking about Aaron or the genealogy in general. He's talking about this specific guy. What we're going to get in this next set, in the rest of this paragraph, is the author's assurance that, once again, Yahweh is the one who's in charge of everything that's going on, and a summary of everything that's going to happen in these chapters that we're looking at today. Now, before we get any further, it can sometimes be confusing how the author of Ezra will use Assyria or Babylon or Persia interchangeably, especially since Ezra is going up from Babylon while there is a Persian king on the throne. I think what makes the most sense is that Babylon is the actual location that Ezra is at, that he's in the city of Babylon, and that he's leaving the city of Babylon to go to the city of Jerusalem with this posse that he gathers around him. So it's not a metaphor for coming out of captivity, even though Babylon does seem to be used as a metaphor for captivity elsewhere. Ezra is literally leaving Babylon, and he's literally going to Jerusalem. In the first sentence, the author focuses on two things. First, that the Persian government is immediately involved in Ezra going up from Babylon, and that second, God is ultimately involved in Ezra going up from Babylon. It says that Ezra is a scribe. We are so used to the scribes and the Pharisees being Jewish religious leaders in the New Testament, and you know, they have conflict with Jesus and so on, that the English word scribe doesn't really give us the sense of what's happening here. Apparently, the Hebrew word underlying scribe could be translated secretary, and then apparently it's a technical term for a Persian office. So on the one hand, the author tells us that Ezra is a Persian official who came up from Babylon. On the other hand, he's skilled in the law of Moses, which Yahweh of Israel had given. The second part of the sentence is that, on the one hand, the king gave him all he requested, showing us how the Persian government was involved. But on the other hand, this happened because the hand of Yahweh his God was upon him. So as I was recalling the beginning of Ezra, we remember that the author of Ezra is adamant that Cyrus is doing what he's doing because God stirred him up, and that the people are going to Jerusalem because God stirred him up. Now, it was the case that Cyrus had political reasons for doing what he was doing, and it was the case that, in at least for some of those people who were going up to Israel, that they were doing that for economic reasons. Even so, Yahweh is ultimately responsible for what is happening to Cyrus, what is happening to the people of Israel who went to Jerusalem, and he's responsible for what's happening with Ezra and for what's happening with Artaxerxes. So after that first sentence, the section summarizes what we'll read more about in a little bit. Okay, so they're Israelites of all different stripes. They're Levites. They're temple servants. There's some people. They're priests. They come up to Jerusalem with Ezra. They arrive 4 months after leaving Babylon, which is good time, again, because Yahweh is taking care of them. So this is just summarizing what we're gonna sort of delve into in detail in the next little bit. I'm not quite sure what to do with the final sentence of this paragraph. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of Yahweh and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. In English, we have punctuation to help us with the logic of sentences, but there isn't punctuation in the same sort of way in Hebrew. So there's a lot of left to interpretation. A lot of the grammar is left to the words, the syntax, instead of to the punctuation. So it could be that what he's saying here is that the reason why Ezra was successful in doing everything he did was because he was interested in the law of God. On the other hand, it could be that there's a very long parenthetical statement where it sort of lays out everything that happened on their journey, and that the reason, so it's going all the way back to the phrase about Ezra being a scribe skilled in the law of Moses, and that it's telling us the reason why he was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses is that he studied the Torah. That seems unlikely, but we have seen very long parentheticals elsewhere in Ezra, so I'm not really sure what to do there. It seems sort of added there at the end. I'm not sure quite how to take it. But it is clear that Ezra wants to teach the Torah and that Yahweh has a hand in letting him do that. So that's very important to the purposes of the author of the book, is letting us know that Ezra is very interested in teaching the Torah and that Yahweh is going to get him to where he can do that. So now we're going to see how that comes about. Paragraph 30. Now this is the copy of the decree which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, learned in the words of the commandments of Yahweh and his statutes to Israel. So before I go and read this letter, this is the final part of Ezra that drops into Aramaic. We saw in the prologue that there was a section that was in Aramaic that started with a letter to Artaxerxes and then continued in Aramaic for some time afterward until the prologue ended in Hebrew. This letter is in Aramaic, and presumably the reason is in Aramaic is because Ezra or whoever put the book of Ezra and Nehemiah together just had a copy of this letter and pasted it or copied it Aramaic as it was, just straight into the text. Aramaic, it was the lingua franca of the ancient Near East, at least at this time, and so the author of Ezra and Nehemiah was just expecting his audience to be able to read this without sort of missing a beat. So here's the letter, and it's in Aramaic, and it's only for the length of the letter. There isn't any Aramaic in Ezra after this. I'm not sure if there's Aramaic in Nehemiah. I haven't looked at that again. So here's the content of the letter. Artaxerxes, King of Kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace. And now I have issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem may go with you. For as much as you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God which is in your hand, and to bring the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold which you find in the whole province of Babylon, along with the freewill offerings of the people and of the priests, who offered willingly for the house of their God which is in Jerusalem, with this money, therefore, you shall diligently buy bulls, rams, and lambs, with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God which is in Jerusalem. Whatever seems good to you and to your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you may do according to the will of your God. Also the utensils which are given to you for the service of the house of your God, deliver in full before the God of Jerusalem. The rest of the needs for the house of your God, for which you may have occasion to provide, provide for it from the royal treasury. I, even I, King Artaxerxes, issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the province beyond the river, that whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, may require of you, it shall be done diligently, even up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt as needed. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done with zeal for the house of the God of heaven, so that there will not be wrath against the kingdom of the king and his sons. We also inform you that it is not allowed to impose tax, tribute, or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, Nethinim, or servants of this house of God. You, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God, which is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges, that they may judge all the people who are in the province beyond the river, even all those who know the laws of your God, and you may teach anyone who is ignorant of them. Whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed upon him strictly, whether for death or for banishment or for confiscation of goods or for imprisonment. So, here we have a letter from Artaxerxes to Ezra, which Ezra is to take with him to show people with what authority he's going to do all the things listed in this letter. As I said, the letter is in Aramaic, presumably because they're just copying it from, verbatim, at least for the sections that we have here in the text. It might have been a longer letter. It might have had further instructions. There's some speculations elsewhere in the text that the letter had specific instructions to specific people and so on. But what we're given here is the sections that the author of Ezra and Nehemiah thought that we needed to know. I'm just going to summarize all of the powers which Ezra is given in this letter. First, it grants to anyone who wants to go to Jerusalem with Ezra the power to do so. Ezra is given the power to use the money of both the Persian government and any money he gathers from Persian Jews who are offering, you know, their money voluntarily to fund sacrifices for the temple of God. He has budgetary discretion for any surplus of gold and silver. He is given utensils for the service of God. He is given budgetary discretion from the royal treasury for anything else the temple needs, granted through powers to take from the taxes from the province beyond the river. So there is this idea of the province beyond the river is a phrase we've seen before in Ezra. It's a phrase we'll see several times more. And it's this section of the Persian Empire, which is the section of the Persian Empire that includes Israel. Each locality in the Persian Empire would gather taxes, and some of that would be tribute to the king, but otherwise those taxes would be used for the administrative requirements that were needed for each of those provinces. So Ezra is being given discretion over at least some of that money to do whatever he needs to for the temple of God. This document offers him complete autonomy to practice Hebrew religion as their God requires. It offers tax exemptions for all of the people who are in service in the temple, the Levites, the priests, it lists several other groups, the Nethinim. All of those folks are exempt from taxes. And finally, it gives Ezra the power to appoint magistrates and judges over the province beyond the river, so this particular section, not just Israel, so that the governmental regulations of the Torah will not be abridged. Okay, so they can run the province beyond the river under the Mosaic law. And they're given enough power to pass judgment, whether they need to have capital punishment or banishment. There's some argument about whether banishment, this word that is translated here as banishment, could also mean corporal punishment. But in any case, they have power of capital punishment, either banishment or corporal punishment, to confiscate goods or to imprison people. So they are given a lot of power to punish people if they are not following this. And it gives them the ability to teach anyone who is ignorant of the Torah. So not only do they have the power to punish according to the Mosaic law, they're also given power to teach anybody in the provinces beyond the river what the Mosaic law entailed. So this is a huge amount of power that Ezra is being given here. This is sort of unprecedented, as far as I know, in the history of Israel. We will talk about why this might have been the case in a little at the end. I have some comments about this. For right now, it suffices to say that Artaxerxes is trusting Ezra with a huge amount of power. And here is how Ezra responds. I will note that when we have this response, he is giving this response in the first person. It's almost as if so far Ezra or whoever has put this together has sort of written out what has happened, and now we're getting a diary entry or something. So here's what Ezra says. Blessed be Yahweh, the God of our fathers, who has put such a thing as this in the king's heart to adorn the house of Yahweh, which is in Jerusalem, and has extended loving kindness to me before the king and his counselors and before all the king's mighty princes. Thus I was strengthened according to the hand of Yahweh my God upon me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. So Ezra sees that this is the working of Yahweh. He agrees with the author of Ezra Nehemiah, if he himself is not the author of Ezra Nehemiah, that Yahweh is ultimately most responsible for what's going on with the Israelites and with the Persians. Okay, so now that he has the immense gift, he's going to gather a bunch of leaders of Israel to go with him to Jerusalem. I'm going to go ahead and read this section. This is not as bad of a begats as Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, but I'm not going to comment on it as extensively as I probably should, and I'll talk about why in a second. Now, these are the heads of their father's households and the genealogical enrollment of those who went up with me from Babylon in the reign of King Artaxerxes. Of the sons of Phinehas, Gershom. Of the sons of Ithamar, Daniel. Of the sons of David, Hattush. Of the sons of Shechaniah, who was of the sons of Parosh, Zechariah, and with him 150 males who were in the genealogical list. Of the sons of Pahath-Moab, Eliehonai. Of the sons of Zerahiah, and 200 males with him. Of the sons of Zatu, Jeconiah, and the son of Jehaziel, and 300 males with him. Of the sons of Adin, Ebed, the son of Jonathan, and 50 males with him. Of the sons of Elon, Jeshiah, the son of Athaliah, and 70 males with him. And of the sons of Shephadiah, Zebediah, the son of Michael, and 80 males with him. Of the sons of Joab, Obadiah, the son of Jehiel, and 218 males with him. Of the sons of Bani, Shelemith, the son of Josiphiah, and 160 males with him. And of the sons of Bebai, Zechariah, the son of Bebai, and 28 males with him. And of the sons of Azgad, Johanan, the son of Hakaton, and 110 males with him. And of the sons of Adonikim, the last ones, these being their names, Eliphelet, Jeuel, and Shemaiah, and 60 males with them. And of the sons of Bigvai, Uthai, and Zabud, and 70 males with them. So here we have a list of folks who come back with Ezra to Jerusalem. I started to look into what we know about this list, and it's clear to me now that it's highly technical what we know about them, and it's the same sort of things we know about Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7. So I am planning on, at some point, addressing Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, and I will probably fold this list of people into that list as well and say everything I'm going to say about genealogical lists in one message, and maybe it'll be slightly more technical than it usually is and not so narrative driven, but hopefully we can see what there is to see about these lists. I have a few observations about this list, but again, it's not as many as I would if I were really looking into this and saying everything I could say, given what I now know about what we know about this list. First, notice that there are descendants of Ithamar and Eleazar. Those are the first two folks listed. Ithamar and Eleazar are sons of Aaron. I think Ithamar is actually a grandson, and Eleazar is the youngest son of Aaron. But we have high priestly material listed in this list. We also have a guy named Hattush, who is listed as a son of David, and apparently elsewhere in the Bible, we have his relationship to Zerubbabel spelled out. I did not do any more looking into that. I'm relying on commentators for me making that comment. But it is interesting that in this list we have both high priestly stock and kingly stock listed right off the bat. The third thing I would like to observe, and this is most important for what's coming up next in the narrative, is that there are no Levites listed. And that's going to be an issue that Ezra recognizes and that he pursues in the following paragraphs. So let's look at paragraph 33. Now I assembled them at the river that runs to Ahava, where we camped for 3 days. And when I observed the people and the priests, I did not find any Levites there. So I sent for Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jarib, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshullam, leading men, and for Joiarib and Elnathan, teachers. That's a lot of guys named Elnathan. It must have been a popular name at the time. I sent them to Iddo, the leading man at the place Cassiphia, and I told them what to say to Iddo and his brothers, the temple servants at the place Cassiphia, that is to bring ministers to us for the house of our God. So now that we have a head count, we're going to get a more detailed summary of the journey from Babylon to Jerusalem. Ezra notes that he assembled the people at the river Ahava. Ahava was probably a canal of the Euphrates, a section of the Euphrates. It was probably next to a town called Ahava, but we don't know where that is. This is our best guess based on what we know. We don't know where Ahava is. The camp for 3 days, presumably wherever Ahava is, it is a convenient place to camp between Babylon and then somewhere close to Cassiphia. They end up leaving on the 12th day of the first month with everybody that we're going to get in the party. So if they wait for 3 days, we're in the 4th day of the first month, which means they only have 8 days. So Cassiphia is reasonably close, but we can't make any exact predictions based on that information. So as they're camping for 3 days, Ezra notices that they don't have any Levites with them. I think it bears repeating here that a Levite is different from someone who is from the tribe of Levi. Priests and high priests are from the tribe of Levi, but a Levite is a technical term that is a paracultic term. That means they work adjacent to the cultic or the religious rituals. Okay, so the Levites are supposed to cut firewood, and when the tabernacle was around, they carried pieces of the tabernacle. After the temple is built, a division of Levites is commissioned to play instruments for the temple worship. Another division, the sons of Asaph particularly, are commanded to sing and write songs, and we have psalms that are the songs of the sons of Asaph. So the Levites don't have as fancy a job as the priests, but they have a fundamental job to the operation of the temple. So if you don't have Levites, you can't run the temple. The priests can do the important stuff. They're actually interacting with God, mediating between Israel and God. But they can't get their job done if the Levites aren't there to help to sort of assist them with what they need. So Ezra wants to make sure that there are Levites in his contingent, since part of what he's doing is try to restore Moses' teachings on how to run the offerings and so on. And the Levites are a big part of that. Before I go any further, I'd like to just take a minute as an aside to make an observation that I suspect will be substantiated whenever we get to Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7. Many scholars want to place the date of the Torah's composition at about roughly the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So modern scholarship wants to say the Second Temple period, that's when people are sort of getting serious about worshiping Yahweh again. So they need some kind of manual by which to make sure that everybody's falling in line, everybody knows what they're doing. And so that's when the Pentateuch, granted, it's coming from tradition, it's coming from sources, but that's when the Pentateuch sort of reaches the final stage that it does. And that's why the, you know, the priestly voice, you know, has very particular things that it wants to emphasize. They're these sort of warring factions about what is it we want our community to be about in the Second Temple period. And you sort of have these different voices, and this is the time of Ezra and Nehemiah when that finally takes shape and the political battles are hashed out and we get the Pentateuch that we have now. If Ezra and Nehemiah has any sort of authority, if it's any sort of reliable historical record, then that challenges the presumption that the Torah is written during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. In the Mosaic Law, the Levites, who Ezra is sending people off to get here, are supposed to receive a tenth of everything the other tribes sort of gather. And then from that tenth, the Levites are to give a tenth to the priests. And the priests are supposed to live off that tenth that the Levites give them. If the Torah is written during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, why would the priests, who are presumably the ones amassing power for themselves through massaging the ancient traditions to their liking, why would they put themselves in such a precarious position? As we've seen here, there are no Levites in Ezra's company starting out, and there are plenty of, we have at least two listed, and if we look, we have other folks who are priestly families. So we have lots of priests who are supposed to be sustained on a tenth of what the Levites receive. So there would not be enough stuff left over for the priests to be sustained off of the tenth of the Levites. Right? If the Levites are of a certain number, they're not going to be able to sustain the priests off of a tenth of whatever's theirs. So the argument goes, it can't be the case that the Torah is written at this time, because if it had been written in this time, you'd have the priests getting a lot more stuff than the Levites. But since it is the case that the Levites are expected to get more and then the priests above them, the way that the historical oddity worked out in terms of how many there were shows us that the Torah is written way earlier, written in a time where there were way more Levites than there were priests, and that you could have reasonably expected the priests to be sustained by the Levites at the time of Moses versus Ezra and Nehemiah, when because of the eccentricities of history, you now have a lot more priests than you do Levites, and you're still sort of expected to have those numbers work out. In any case, Ezra sends a group of folks to Iddo, who is presumably a Levite himself or a leader of a community that has Levites in it. And he sends the people to ask him if they can spare anyone to come be servants in the temple, presumably as Levites, not just temple servant, as we'll see later in the text, denotes a specific kind of work in the temple. I'm not exactly sure what it entails, but shortly, and in the list we just read, and then in both Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, those folks get separated as if they're a different group. So when I say they're asking for servants of the temple, I mean specifically Levites. It turns out that some of those people are going to end up being temple servants, but I don't think that's what Ezra has in mind. He wants specifically Levites. All right. Paragraph 34. According to the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of insight of the sons of Mahli, the son of Levi, the son of Israel, namely Sherebiah, and his sons and brothers, 18 men. And Hashabiah and Jeshiah of the sons of Merari, with his brothers and their sons, 20 men. And 220 of the temple servants, whom David and the princes had given for the service of the Levites, all of them designated by name. So Ezra sends this delegation to Iddo to ask if they have anybody who they could spare to come to Israel or to come to Jerusalem. And the delegation is successful. There's a guy named Sherebiah, who is a descendant of Mahli. Mahli, we know, is one of the lines of the Levites. And then there's also Hashabiah and Jeshiah, who are from the Levitical line of Merari. So Merari and Mahli, I think there are four lines. I don't remember what all of them are, but Mahli and Merari are two of them. And we have folks who come from both of those lines, and their names are Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and Jeshiah. And they bring a total of 38 men with them, right? 18 from the Mahlians. I hope that's the right term. And 20 from the Merarians. Additionally, they have 220 temple servants who come with them. The text notes that David and the princes were involved in giving the servants to the Levites. When we were going through Ezra earlier, we saw when the instruments were played when the Jews were breaking ground on the second temple, the contributions and innovations that David made to how the worship ought to be conducted was very important. So we just continue to see that David's contributions to how to run worship, how to what they call technically the cultic practice, right? David's contributions and innovations on the cultic practice are very important to Ezra and Nehemiah. It's not just in the tradition of Moses, because there's been innovation, there's been contribution since Moses, right? Ezra is following the law of Moses, but in the author of Ezra and Nehemiah's mind, to keep with the law of Moses and to keep with the innovations that David made are not in tension. And then the end of this sentence says that all of them were designated by name. I take that to mean that Ezra had a census that listed all of these people, all these 258 people, by name. It doesn't list that for us, because that would be very long. But the idea is that he had the census, even if he doesn't list it here. All right, we're going to read a couple of paragraphs here. We're going to read from 821 to 834, which is paragraphs 35 through 38. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a safe journey for us, our little ones and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen to protect us from the enemy on the way, because we had said to the king, "The hand of our God is favorably disposed to all those who seek him, but his power and his anger are against all those who forsake him." So we fasted and sought our God concerning this matter, and he listened to our entreaty. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, and also Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and with them 10 of their brothers. And I weighed out to them the silver, the gold, and the utensils, the offering for the house of our God, which the king and his counselors and his princes and all Israel present there had offered. Thus I weighed into their hands 650 talents of silver, and silver utensils worth 100 talents, and 100 gold talents, and 20 gold bowls worth 1,000 darics, and 2 utensils of fine shiny bronze, precious as gold. Then I said to them, "You are holy to Yahweh, and the utensils are holy, and the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to Yahweh, God of our fathers. Watch and keep them until you weigh them before the leading priests, the Levites, and the head of the fathers' households of Israel at Jerusalem, in the chambers of the house of Yahweh." So the priests and the Levites accepted the weighed out silver and gold and the utensils to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. Then we journeyed from the river Ahava on the 12th of the first month to go to Jerusalem. And the hand of our God was over us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and the ambushes by the way. Thus we came to Jerusalem and remained there 3 days. On the 4th day, the silver and the gold and the utensils were weighed out in the house of our God into the hand of Meremoth, the son of Uriah the priest, and with him was Eleazar, the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites, Jozabad, the son of Jeshua, and Noadiah, the son of Binui. Everything was numbered and weighed, and all the weight was recorded at that time. So now we're going to get more they had this little detour. They had to go get Levites to be a part of their party, and now we're actually going to get the record of their journey. Ezra calls for everyone to fast before they set out. They're asking God for a safe journey. Ezra tells us that he did not want to request an armed escort because of what he had told the king of how God works in history. Since they cannot rely on an armed escort, however, they have to rely on God. Fortunately, he tells us at the end of the paragraph, God listened to their request. Now, as they're setting out, Ezra picks 12 priests and 12 Levites. We know that Hashabiah and Sherebiah are both Levites because they're two of the guys listed who came from Edo. So there's two parts to the sentence. The first is he took 12 priests, and then he took Hashabiah and Sherebiah and their 10 brothers. So we have 24 men, two sets of 12, 12 priests, 12 Levites, and he gives those 24 men all of this wealth that he's entrusting to them to bring to the temple and to Jerusalem so they can measure it out and make sure that it's delivered to the leading men of Jerusalem. Ezra seems to be of the opinion that they took this task on. And as we get, you know, to the end of the story here, it seems like nothing went awry and that all of the goods that they had been entrusted with arrived safely. Fincham, who is one of the commentators that I look at as I work through here, he notes that the division of the 12 priests and the 12 Levites is important because according to the Mosaic law, there are certain utensils that only priests can carry, and there are certain utensils that only Levites can carry. He doesn't elaborate on which utensils are allowed to be carried by priests and which are allowed to be carried by Levites. But it seems likely that that's the sort of thing that gets commanded in the law. I did not, however, hunt this down and find out. So I cannot definitively say here's the law that commands that. But I think it's likely, and if Fincham is correct, that speaks to Ezra's concern with observing the law that Moses had put into place, because he's concerned that the proper people do the proper thing, that the Levites only carry what the Levites have been commissioned to carry, and that the priests only carry what the priests have been commissioned to carry. So the whole group leaves Ahava, and they make it safely to Jerusalem. It's likely they would have gone through the Fertile Crescent. If we look at the dates here, I trust other people when they tell me that this is summer, so you would not have wanted to go through the desert. From Babylon to Israel, you would have gone through the Fertile Crescent. And it's about 900 miles, they tell me, to get from Babylon to Israel through the Fertile Crescent. It's about 500 miles through the desert, but it would have been too hot. And it notes that they had little ones, which apparently in the Hebrew, that means it's literally the weak ones. So apparently that term can refer to both wives and children. The people who are not, who don't make a habit of going out and journeying through the desert. So they had a long trip, but it appears that they didn't run into any trouble. In the NASB, it translates the section, "He delivered us from the hand of the enemy in the ambushes by the way." That makes it sound like they had all these swashbuckling adventures evading bandits. But the commentators tell me that the Hebrew makes it clear that they just didn't run into any trouble. They were protected from trouble rather than snatched out of, you know, they didn't have to make a hairbreadth escape. They just avoided it altogether. And then they arrive in Jerusalem, and the men who Ezra had entrusted to carry the gold and silver were reliable people, and they delivered their charges to the temple, and everything tallied. It's interesting that the person who receives the good is Meremoth. We are told in Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7, apparently. We will get to Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7 at some point. But there is a section that lists families who were unable to prove their priestly lineage at the time that the list of Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7 was composed. So presumably back in the time of Zerubbabel and Joshua, Meremoth's family could not show for certain that they were supposed to be priests, and at the time they were prevented to be priests until they could prove otherwise. So in the intervening years between the return of those folks who were with Zerubbabel and Jeshua, Meremoth has apparently found evidence that he is a legitimate priest. The thing that Ezra 2 says is that the people who could possibly be priests should refrain from being priests until they found the Urim and Thummim, which is this sort of technical device that the high priest is supposed to have. Apparently, we have some idea of the mechanism of it. It seems to have worked by lots, and you would ask a yes or no question, something to that effect, we speculate. And it may have been the case that the exiles came back and they had enough knowledge to know how to set that up and put that together. As far as I know, the Urim and Thummim are not something that are sort of developed in the law. It doesn't spell out what those things are. It just notes them. So you would have to know what those things were in order to be able to use them or to construct them or whatever you have to do in order for them to work properly. In any case, Meremoth, the Hebrew apparently says they weighed the gold and silver in the hand of Meremoth. So by this time, his family has been legitimized to be priests, and he receives these contributions that the men are bringing from Babylon. All right, paragraph 39. The exiles who had come from the captivity offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all of Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, 12 male goats for a sin offering, all as a burnt offering to Yahweh. Then they delivered the king's edicts to the king's satraps and to the governors in the provinces beyond the river, and they supported the people in the house of God. Okay, so the folks have come back from exile. They've successfully made it through. They've successfully traveled from Babylon to Jerusalem. They offer burnt offerings to God. The numbers that are listed here for the animals are interesting, and I have no idea what they mean. Obviously, there are 12 of each of the bulls and goats. Anything with 12 makes you want to associate it with the 12 tribes of Israel. Who knows if that's right? 96 can be divided by 12. There is some textual evidence that 77 should be 72. The Masoretic text has 77, but the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, has 72, which is also divisible by 12. On the other hand, 7 is 11 sevens, you know, and if you didn't count one of the tribes, then maybe there's 7 lambs for each of the tribes that are counted. But I don't know enough about the offerings, particularly the sin offerings, which this passage specifies that they were making, to know how to go about knowing how to deal with these numbers. I think it is part of the task as we move forward, as I move forward, as we think about Hebrew cultural literacy, which is one of these ideas that David's been talking about, to think about why the number of offerings are what they are. We saw earlier in Ezra that they did all of the offerings for Sukkot. And as I said at the time, Sukkot has a very complicated system for how you're supposed to offer things. And why they offer the number of offerings they do. But as David has said elsewhere, I am convinced that it's significant. And I think it's something that we need to think about more as we continue to think about this question of Hebrew cultural literacy. I presume, because it doesn't say to the contrary, that this was an acceptable sort of offering. The whole paragraph sort of has this, and then they did everything they were supposed to do. And notice that what they did first was that they offered offerings to God, and then they did the political stuff, right? Then they took the king's edicts to the king's satraps and the governors, which is one thing that they were supposed to do, but it's interesting that it's been ordered the way that it has. I mean, it could have possibly been ordered by the people of the time. They just thought it was more important to do the religious stuff before they did the political stuff. And so they do both the offerings and the political things. Everything that Artaxerxes' edict expected them to do, they did, including fulfilling the religious requirements that they put on themselves. So I assume that what they did here was correct, and I assume what they did here has significance. But I don't know, I can't develop it any further at this point along the road. So after they do these sacrifices, they deliver the king's edicts to the king's satraps and to the governors in the provinces beyond the river. So this one location that has these different people, they go to them, they tell them what they're going to do. And in an English, it sounds, comma, and they, who's the they? It could be the exiles. The exiles supported the people in the house of God. But I think it's more likely that it's the governors and satraps, because of the instructions and the edict that they give out of the royal treasury and taxes and so on. So they go and tell the satraps and governors what they're supposed to do, and the satraps and governors do what they're supposed to do, and what they're supposed to do is to support the people and the house of God. Okay, so I have a couple of comments. So the first thing to talk about is, why did Artaxerxes send Ezra to Jerusalem? In Ezra 1, we are told that God stirred up Cyrus to do what he did. And we have some precedent in sort of the political machinations of the Persian Empire for the Persians wanting people to go back to their historic homes and do their historic religions. But here, we don't have that same kind of language. We're not told that Artaxerxes is stirred up. We just are told that Ezra is a talented scribe in the law of Moses, and then King Artaxerxes gives him everything he asks for, and then we're given the edict that Artaxerxes wrote. So we don't have the same kind of direct commentary on the reasons that Artaxerxes is doing the things he's doing as we do for Cyrus. Now, in the language of the edict, we do have some interesting things that might go towards explaining why Artaxerxes is doing the things he's doing. He says that whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done with zeal for the house of the God of heaven, so that there will not be wrath against the kingdom of the king and his sons. Now, in Cyrus's edict, he had similar language, right? Please do your ceremonies on my behalf, that sort of thing. And Artaxerxes seems to have a similar thing here. Please do whatever you need to do so that the God of heaven doesn't have wrath against my kingdom. But if Persia has a general policy of letting people do what they're going to do, then it would just be part of the nicety of interacting with a particular people that you would ask them to have their God bless you, right? There are all these different gods for each locality. Each of them has some amount of power, but not absolute power. And if you were talking to Phoenicians, you ask the Phoenicians for their God to be nice to you, and that's going to cover your bases in Phoenicia. And if you're talking to the Greeks, the Athenians, about their, their God, that's going to cover you in Athens. But it's not going to give you sort of, coverage for everything. So it doesn't necessarily speak to Artaxerxes' motives that he really has devotion to Yahweh and that he expects Yahweh to sort of take care of him in the way that the whole Old Testament sort of assumes that Yahweh takes care of people. He's in charge of everything. I don't think that Artaxerxes is a true devotee of Yahweh. I don't think he thinks that Yahweh is the one true God who is going to be the only way for him to have any sort of protection. He's just sort of giving this, the sort of spiel that you'd give to every group and saying, yeah, have your God be on my behalf as well. And that works out for, it works for Persia because he gets to say, you guys have something going. But on the other hand, he can still, have his own gods. So I think if we're going to understand the motives for Artaxerxes sending Ezra to Jerusalem, we have to understand a little bit more about the history of what was going on at the time that Ezra goes off to Babylon. As I have said before, I don't know tons about history. But I did do some research, and I think that is very interesting. In 460 BC, if we can sort of locate ourselves in history, so Artaxerxes is the son of Darius. If you remember, Darius was the Persian emperor during the Battle of Marathon. Okay, Marathon is this sort of classic battle between Athens and the Persian forces. Depending on who's telling the story, the Athenians sort of have no hope of winning, and Athens manages to defeat the Persians at Marathon. Famously, the guy runs to Athens to let them know what's going on. And this is a moment for Athens to sort of buttress itself and to believe that the values of democracy and sort of Greek, science and philosophy are what propelled them to victory over the sort of enslaved, petty, fearful values of the Persians. So Greece sort of gets some confidence after the Battle of Marathon, and eventually this is going to result in what we now think of as the Peloponnesian War. Athens is going to get pretty big for its britches, and it's going to subsume a bunch of other Greek city-states and their wealth under its umbrella. And eventually those city-states who are being oppressed by Athens are going to appeal to Sparta to help them out, because Sparta is the only city-state who can pose any sort of credible military, threat to Athens. And it basically ends, everybody sort of loses because Athens has a extremely formidable navy and Spartans have the best warriors, you know, land warriors in the world. And when you can't win with your navy and you can't win with your infantry because the other side wants to fight the war on, you know, on different, not just fronts, but different sort of modes of warfare, there isn't really a way to determine that. And ultimately they both end up kind of, Sparta kind of wins, but they end up being weakened, and eventually Alexander rolls through and ends the whole thing. But we're in 460, and this is after the Battle of Marathon, right? Artaxerxes is leading, and the Greeks are fomenting trouble because they are still sort of in this phase of gaining confidence in their own abilities. So apparently, I'm just going to read here from an article I found on this situation. In 460 BC, the Confederation of Greek Cities under Athenian leadership, known as the Attic Delic League, sent a fleet of 200 war galleys against Persia in the Cypriotic seas. This fleet sailed to Egypt, gained a great victory over the Persian army there, and captured Memphis in the autumn of 459. This placed the coast of Palestine and Phoenicia into Greek hands as the only possible route from Ionia to Egypt. And then it has an inscription which details this. So the Greeks, as they're sort of fomenting issues, they go to Egypt and they take over Egypt. And they are controlling an important route that the Persians would depend on for supplies if they were going to wage any sort of war in that area. I'm going to read a little bit more here. This line of supply and communication of the Greek expeditionary force relied upon the cities of the Philistines, who were of Greek descent, and on the district of Dor, which extended from the Philistine to the Sidonian border. Okay, so in order for the Greeks to get supplies, they needed the Philistines, who apparently were of Greek descent. I did not know this. I did not realize this. I know that they were the sea peoples, but I'm bad at history. So apparently they're depending on the Philistines to get them supplies. The Philistines are very famously a historical enemy of the Israelites. So part of Artaxerxes' motivation, it seems, is to strengthen Israel so that the Philistines will be distracted by Israel and allow the Persians to do what they will with a little bit of impunity from retaliation from the Greeks. So when Artaxerxes sends this letter, it is interesting that he wants to give Ezra the power to instantiate Torah in the entire province beyond the river. Because that means that you would be exercising Torah to a greater extent than you had ever done historically. And that the powers that Israel possessed to punish people within that region would have sort of unprecedented ability to do that. Presumably the idea here is that the Philistines, who have been at odds with Israel long into their history, would see the power that Israel is amassing and be very, very afraid of that and begin to make moves to prevent that from happening or harass Israel or whatever, in which case the problems that the Philistines ends up causing are not for Persia, who's trying to conduct business in Egypt and in the seas and so on, but rather for Israel. And, you know, because Artaxerxes isn't necessarily wanting to just sort of offer the Israelites up on a platter to the Philistines, he gives them a lot of power to do what they're going to do in their area. And presumably if they could, they would sort of quash any rebellions that came about because of Philistines stirring up trouble in their land. So the reasons why Artaxerxes is eager to pass religious reforms in Israel, as far as we can tell, at least from the historical evidence, is for political reasons. He wants his enemies in this big war that he's conducting, or it's not even a war that he's conducting, but these people who he is concerned with, this emerging world power that he is concerned with, he wants them to be less of a problem for him than they have been, or that they could potentially be, if they go undisturbed. And he aims to disturb them by allowing Israel to have its historic religion and enforce that historic religion to the extent that he can. It's interesting that in talking to King Artaxerxes, that Ezra says that he is ashamed to ask for troops. And he says the following to the king: "The hand of our God is favorably disposed to all those who seek him, but his power and his anger against all those who forsake him." So the way that Artaxerxes is reading that, and maybe even to some extent the way that Ezra is presenting this, is, look, the way that God is working is you have to be on his side. And if you're against his side, then he's going to come after you. He's going to bring judgment to you. And this is the sort of thing that King Artaxerxes really wants to hear, because if there are groups of people who are closely related to the Philistines, and suddenly you give the Israelites all of this power over that area, and you have someone in charge who wants Yahweh's way or the highway, then all of the people who could be potentially bothering the Persians, they suddenly have this other thing to worry about. And yet, the author of Ezra Nehemiah continues to be adamant that God is generously blessing the people of Israel through the work of Artaxerxes and through Ezra. That's very interesting, and it's very comforting, because we live in strange political times. I don't really want to talk about politics right now, but I feel, and I have felt as I have worked in these past years to understand American history and my responsibility as an American citizen, that there is so much that's complicated about being a responsible citizen. The issues are often presented as very simple issues, but the more and more I look at them, the more I'm convinced that they are very, very complicated. And the more that I think that the solution is to be more and more local, because that's something that I could ultimately affect, I think, in a way that's actually realistic, the more the issues get more and more complicated, and the more I have to learn about. It's very easy to sort of tell myself a story about what's going on in the nation as a whole. It's very difficult to actually figure out what is happening right here in a way where I can use that responsibly to vote, etc. But what the author of Ezra and Nehemiah is saying is that just because Artaxerxes has these apathetic, and in some cases, right, if the Philistines rise up against Israel, then Israel's in trouble, and it's sort of like, well, now, you know, just leave them as a sheep to the slaughter, and then we don't, you know, we don't have to deal with the Philistines if they're dealing with Israel. Just because there are even nefarious political machinations going on, that doesn't mean that God isn't working through those things. And it might have been the case that Ezra kind of got a sense that what was going on with the king is that he wanted to know that Ezra was going to be sort of pro, Yahweh religion, and so he sort of fed that sort of stuff to the king, and to the extent that he didn't want to ask the king for any protection, because that would have sent the king the wrong sort of message. But even so, God was really working in history to bring about his purposes, and Ezra really did want to teach the Torah of Moses. Both of those things are really clear from the text. So it may be the case that in, you know, the real world of politics, in the real world of history, things get very complicated and people have very mixed motives. And yet, God is working in history the way that he wants to. And because we are participants in a complicated system, it does not mean that we do not value the things we value, because things are not turning out the way that we wanted them to, or because in some cases we end up playing political games. I don't want to try to give anybody license to not think about how they're going to vote because of what this is saying. But if we are truly committed to the Torah of Yahweh, right? If we're really committed to God, even if we are in a messy world, we can still really be committed to that. And even if the world historical leadership around us hates God and is working against the purposes of God, ultimately you can't work against the purposes of God. God is in control whether you are for him or against him, and he is going to resolve things the way that he wants. That's not always pleasant, because it means that we have to give up things that we thought were going to bring us comfort or ease or happiness. You know, when I have my head on straight, it is very comforting to know that God is in control of history, even as it's very messy and complicated and in some cases nefariously political. We saw in the prologue that God is very interested in blessing the people of Israel. I compared it to the Exodus, and we see that God is even blessing the people more than he did in the Exodus, because in the Exodus, he wasn't forgiving them in the same way he was when he was bringing them out of the Babylonian captivity. And I think similarly in this section, we're seeing Ezra wants to teach the law of God, and he is given extraordinary authority to teach the law of God. And he sees this, you know, he doesn't take this as an excuse to sort of do whatever he wants. He sees this as God working to further God's purposes, and he is thankful that God is doing that. All right, I feel that that's all I have to say. So far, we have seen this first section that I keep, you know, if there's five parts to Ezra Nehemiah, we've been solidly in the first section of God blessing people and helping them complete political projects despite whatever opposition there might be. Next week, we're going to start to get into the B section, which is showing us the sort of more fundamental spiritual problems that are in the heart of Israel. And by the end of Ezra and Nehemiah, we will see sort of a meditation on how to deal with that more fundamental problem. All right. Thank you for your attention, and we'll see you guys next week.